So I'm going to welcome to the skinny on why we get fat and what to do about it. Thank you for coming. And some of you I know, and some of you I'm just meeting for the first time. So thanks for coming. I just came back from maternity leave about 3 months ago after having my third baby. And I decided that I wanted to lose weight a little faster this time than I did for the second baby. So I was going to take an active role in doing something. And we had some people over for dinner one night, and the husband was talking about something which I'm going to tell you about a little later. And I started taking it. I was just adding, it's an oil actually, I just started adding it to my shake in the morning, and I noticed that I was I wasn't getting hungry. Usually I would eat my lunch like around 11:30 so that I could prevent the afternoon crash. And I didn't need to eat, and I didn't have the afternoon crash that I would have if I did that. And so it kind of spurned on a lot of research on my end, and then me getting other friends and family to try this other way of eating, and it worked across the board. And so now I've started using it with patients, and but I've been helping people lose weight for over 10 years, and I've gone through different iterations of what I think is the best diet for people. And most people would lose weight on some form of diet, but I'm also always using other medical reasons why people don't lose weight, so which I'm going to talk about tonight. And then I came across this, which makes so much sense to me. But so what I'm going to talk about tonight is the reasons why we don't lose weight, and all of the other medical reasons, and then partly about food. And food is obviously the biggest thing for most people, not necessarily the medical things. But and then next time I'm going to talk about what to do about it. If you have any questions along the way, feel free to ask. This slide doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Why were most people thin before 1975? So last night my husband was looking at this and he said, thin before what? And so I decided I should come up with a number, so 1975. And actually in 1975, between 12 and 14% of the United States was obese. And fast forward 10 years, and it had gone up to over 25%. And so that's why they call it the obesity epidemic. That's like another 10% of the entire population, which is millions and millions of people, had gained all this weight, and nobody knew why. So when I say why were most people thin before, which is actually what I originally meant to say, before I added in the 1975, there is a book that I read a few years ago. It's called Kitchen Literacy. And it talks about the development of processed foods starting in the late 1700s. And so I don't think most of us realize that processed food has been happening since then. And she starts off talking about a woman named Martha, who I believe lived in Pennsylvania. She had a farm, and she had livestock. She had chickens, and she had milk from her cows and eggs from her chickens and meat from those animals, and had a vegetable garden. And if she couldn't get everything that she needed from her farm, she would trade for it with neighbors, or maybe, you know, I believe sugar was processed at that time, so, but not most people couldn't afford sugar. So that's where it started. And this was from a diary from a woman that was found from the 1700s. So it was interesting. So then she starts off talking about, because the Industrial Revolution, people moved to cities, and so people didn't have farms, and they didn't have space to have animals. And so canning was one of the things that started in the 1800s. And one of the things that was very challenging for companies that made canned goods, and most of it was, they started off as vegetables, was that because it was an ugly thing that you couldn't see through, nobody wanted to buy it. And nobody had ever experienced this buying, eating something out of a can. It was completely foreign to humans. So they had to, you know, they would develop labels that had pretty pictures on them and things like that. And then they fast forward, I don't know, another 50 years, and they started packaging meat. And how that started, they had, say, New York City, they had to get the cow meat from Texas to New York. And they would take, first they started taking animals by train. And the animals would get sick and die before they got to New York. So they decided that it would be better to kill the animal in Texas and transport the meat to New York. So then they had to figure out the whole storage problem and keeping it from going bad. And then they had the problem of people looking at a piece of meat in a supermarket. They were used to going to the butcher and even seeing the animal and saying, oh, I want this animal and I want this cut from this animal. And they knew that the meat was healthy because they could see the animal that it was coming from. I don't go to Whole Foods now and think, oh, I wonder what this animal looked like. I just say, oh, does this meat look healthy? So this whole process of changing our minds about the way food is and what it actually means to be processed has completely changed in the last 150 years. And so now we're at the point, you know, when I'll have a patient, let's say, well, how many Cokes can I drink a day? Like, Coke is not healthy. I know they know that, but they think I'm being totally unrealistic by asking them to not have any Coke and maybe drink only water. Anyway, so food was not available in unlimited quantities as it is today. We couldn't go to a supermarket at 3 o'clock in the morning and buy Twinkies. We didn't eat processed foods. There were no, so something that happened, actually I looked this up the other day, Crisco was developed in 1910. It was the first time they made vegetable oil to replace lard. And, or at least that's when Crisco was first one on the market. And now we know vegetable oil is inflammatory and contributes to heart disease, and the saturated fat that it has been demonized for so long does not, and nor does cholesterol. Animals and fish grew in their natural environments and ate their natural diet and were actually good for us. So we have fish that are now eating corn and farmed in places. So now they're, you know, they toxic chemicals are in their water, and we have mercury coming from all places, and the cows are eating corn and they're supposed to eat grass. And something interesting that I read the other day was that, and I didn't think about this, but that farmers have known for hundreds of years how to fatten an animal and by feeding them grain. So we all, for the last 30 years, have been eating whole grains to try and lose weight and be healthy, when that was the very thing that people have known for a very long time would fatten animals, and we're really not any different from the animals. So, and just the last thing, which is all, it's all the same thing, but we ate what was natural, what was available. And we couldn't overconsume things, and most of the times things weren't available in abundance, so we couldn't overconsume calories, and we couldn't consume specific calories, like the things that we decided were healthy or not healthy. So you may have seen this map before. It's a map of obesity in the United States in 2013. So the purple states, I know your handout is pretty tiny, you probably can't read this, but the purple states here, Mississippi and West Virginia, are over 35% fat. And few states are less than 25, which is California, and Utah, Colorado, Montana, Vermont, and Massachusetts. And then the rest of them equal out to so that we're about 30% obesity in the United States. So something I wanted to show you, this is a world map, and white is less than 2%, and it goes all the way to greater than 30%. So this is 1975. So before this, not much change. So as the colors get darker, the world's getting fatter, basically. There's a tiny little country here. That's the United Arab Emirates, that they beat 30% the fastest. And so you can see places like India. My husband's Indian, and we looked at this last night. He said, oh, India's still under 2%. That's awesome. And I'm like, yeah, that's because half the people have no food. So you can see this has never, ever happened in the history of the world to people before. So this is a big problem. And it's not... Oh, hold on a sec. So, why did this happen? So I have chosen a few key things that I think have influenced obesity, and not everyone would agree with me, but some of them I think are so obvious. Anyway, so in the 1950s, there was a guy named Ansel Keys, and he got his PhD, and he got two PhDs. He went to Berkeley, and he also went to Cambridge and some other university in Europe. I can't remember where. But he basically did a study that it was called the six-country study. It started off with 22 countries. And by the time he published it, those six countries, it showed that they ate more saturated fat. And he related it to the greater amount of heart disease that those countries had. And that is where the first idea of saturated fat and cholesterol causing heart disease, that's where it came from. And for years, people have known, not very many people, but they've known that this study was faulty. So if you add back all the other countries from those 22 countries, his conclusions fall apart. So sadly, I don't think he meant to impact the world the way he did, but he caused a lot of damage. And actually, he wrote a book. He lived till he was 100, too. But he wrote a book called The Mediterranean Diet, and I think that's probably what he followed. So there was still a lot of fat in his diet, I'm sure. Maybe not saturated, but... So that was the first thing. The second thing, in 1976, George McGovern, the senator George McGovern, had a heart attack maybe a few years earlier or near that time, and decided through education by somebody, I don't know who, that saturated fat was bad. So he pushed for the development of the first dietary guidelines for Americans, and they recommended that people eat low fat. Then we get to 1984 here, artificial sweeteners. So Donald Rumsfeld was a CEO of Searle Pharmaceuticals. And in the late 1960s, or maybe the 70s, they were developing an ulcer drug. And one of the developers noticed that it tasted incredibly sweet. And the ulcer drug was a flop. So they tried to repurpose it and decided they wanted to use it as an artificial sweetener. And actually in 1985, I think Monsanto bought Searle or they bought NutraSweet, but it became NutraSweet. That's what NutraSweet is. And one of the reasons this artificial sweetener, aspartame, is bad is because it comes it breaks down into a few different things. One is methanol, which is toxic, formaldehyde, which is a known carcinogen, animal carcinogen, but we're animals, and aspartate. And aspartate is called an excitotoxin. And excitotoxins have the ability to kill brain cells if they're at a very high level. And they also can just block leptin receptors, which is what makes us feel full, one of the things that make us feel full. So if you ever have consumed a lot of diet soda, you might notice that it actually makes you want to eat more. And aspartate, one of the breakdown product I was just talking about, is the same as glutamate. It does the same thing as glutamate, which is MSG, basically. And MSG, they've known since the 60s, it is neurotoxic and can cause brain damage. So they took it, it used to be in baby food, and they took it out of baby food. And there are still people that deny that MSG is a problem. But aspartame, it basically does the same thing. It does, and on some people, it has a very visible, obvious effect. I had a patient a long time ago, and she used to drink Diet Coke every night or every day, whatever. And she said when she would watch TV, her head would like twitch uncontrolled, like she had no control over it. And when I told her to cut it out, and within like a week or two, the twitching had gone and it had been there for a long time. So aspartame is also the most complained about food product to the FDA in history. 75% of the complaints to the FDA have been at one time were because of aspartame. So aspartame, while it's meant to cause people to help them lose weight, actually makes them gain weight. And the other thing too is MSG. For researchers to study MSG or study obesity, they are called MSG obese mice. They use MSG in order to induce obesity. And so they know this. They've known this for a long time. And so aspartate, which is an amino acid, as is glutamate, they both can do this. And anyway, it's not a good thing. So that all, I think, is not the biggest part of the obesity epidemic by far, but it is part, I think. And then we have 1984, high fructose corn syrup replaces glucose or table sugar in soda. And fructose, if you look at the biochemical pathway, bypasses a step in the energy production. And so fructose goes right into making fat. And sugar, your body has to decide whether it has an enzyme for this or not. And so it goes into making energy. But if you have too much fructose, it goes right into making fat. It gets made into triglycerides. So this whole thing about fat, fruit being healthy, I'm not saying it's unhealthy, but the sugar in fruit is not... like table sugar, to be honest, is better than fruit sugar. So that's a pretty bold statement to make, and I have people say to me all the time, well, but fruit is healthy, so it's fruit sugar. It's fruit sugar is good for me. Fruit sugar, biochemically, your body doesn't care. It bypasses and gets made into fat if there's too much of it. If it goes too quickly. So, you know, and fruit, to be fair, fruit has fiber and has all these other things. So it has nutrients that are good for you. But the fiber slows down the fructose from being absorbed. So it may get a chance to just be made into energy rather than into fat. But there are lots of people I know who eat way more than one or two pieces of fruit a day. They're eating like, you know, in excess of 5, 6, 7, 8 pieces of fruit a day. So it's not helping their weight. So fructose, the reason high fructose corn syrup is so bad is because the free fructose, again, there's so much fructose, your body can't handle it, and it just gets made straight into fat. So for people who drink a lot of soda, a really easy way to lose weight is to just stop drinking soda. So we have high fructose corn syrup, which also results in insulin resistance or is a cause of insulin resistance. And so if I'll talk about more about insulin resistance in a little bit, but insulin resistance also makes us gain more weight. So it's not just the sugar. It's what the sugar does to us that makes us gain more weight too. And then we have in the 1980s, sugar replaces fat. So when I was in college, I don't know why I was looking, but I used to eat Skippy peanut butter when I was in undergrad. I still, actually, we on summer vacation this year, the people we were staying with had Skippy, and I was like, oh, I want to try that. So I did, and it just did not taste as good as it used to. At least my, I guess my tastes have changed, but I looked and there's still hydrogenated oils in there. It's still trans fat. And something interesting to know is that all these things that have say they've reduced the trans fats, as long as something is below 0.5 grams per serving, you can call it zero trans fat. So a lot of companies just changed the serving size and they didn't change anything else about the product. So it's a little bit of trickery going on. Anyway, so Skippy, when I was 19, I went and bought low-fat Skippy because my roommate at the time was obsessed with she was obsessed with losing weight, and everything she ate, she bought no-fat cheese. I don't even know how that's possible, but no low-fat everything. So I looked at the low-fat jar of Skippy, and then I looked at the regular jar of Skippy, and I noticed that there was more sugar and less fat. And that was 23 years ago, probably. So sugar is what makes us fat. Fat is not what makes us fat. So this has been going on for a long time. And I know another thing that they've done with fat is to replace the saturated fat with vegetable oils, which actually cause a lot of problems too. And my mother-in-law came up to me the last time we were in India, which was 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And she was so proud to show me the oil that she had. It said heart healthy, blah, 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 blah. And it was this mixture of refined oils. And I was like, oh, God. I told her she needed to change her oil. But that's what people are being taught around the world. And nobody knows. Nobody knows. And why would they? Like, nobody's taught nutrition in school. Unless you really dig for it. I'm astounded at the number of naturopaths who don't really know a whole lot about nutrition, but it's just because I'm interested in this kind of stuff that I know a little bit more than some other people. Okay, so I've already talked about that. So, and actually, I guess one thing to add is that when people think they're eating something low fat, they think it gives them the license to eat a lot more of it. And it, just an example, like Snackwells and Oreo cookies, like their low-fat version, has, I think it's six calories different from the no-fat or from the regular version. It's just that they've added enough sugar to equate just about the same amount of calories. And that sugar is doing so much more damage than the fat that they've removed. So what makes us fat? So these are the medical reasons why people get fat that I know of, that I treat all the time. So I'll just read through them, and then we'll go into detail for each one of them. So food sensitivities, hypothyroidism, candida or other gut infections, sex hormones, insulin resistance, stress hormones, and too many carbohydrates. So why food sensitivities? How can a food sensitivity make you gain weight? And what is a food sensitivity? Does anybody, are you familiar? Have you heard of food sensitivities before? You have, yeah? Not really. So a food sensitivity basically develops because of leaky gut. And leaky gut is actually, I don't know if there's a more medical term for it, but that is the term that doctors are using now. And people who have studied more recently, like even medical doctors, know that leaky gut is an actual thing. So leaky gut, you have cells in the wall of your small intestine. They're called enterocytes. And the enterocytes are linked by tight junctions. So if you imagine a row of army men or women linking arms, the linking arms are the tight junctions, and the person would be the cell. So if there's damage and the arms drop, protein can get in. Protein is not supposed to be in your bloodstream. Your body's supposed to break it down to amino acids before it gets to your bloodstream. If your body sees protein, it attacks it. So if it sees a protein from a food, it's going to attack it just like it does bacteria or virus or any other foreign thing that's in there. That's kind of why, like vaccines, they inject whole proteins right into your bloodstream. One, my opinion is that maybe one of the reasons why kids have so many peanut allergies now is because some of the vaccines have peanut oil in them, because their immune system's getting exposed to something it never should have been exposed to. So reasons why these tight junctions can open up are gluten can open them, stress can open them, just a poor diet can open them, antibiotics can open them. So all kinds of things can open them, and most of us have experienced at least one of those things. And if the cell itself is incredibly damaged, then things can also get through that way. So what happens when you have a leaky gut then is the protein, because it hasn't been broken down into the amino acid yet, which is the building blocks of protein, goes through to the bloodstream, and the immune system reacts and sends out an army of folks to fight it. And so when you have a food sensitivity, every time you eat that thing, it goes and attacks and can cause literally any symptom that you might have. It can cause joint pain. It can cause heart palpitations. It can cause an increase in blood pressure. It can cause fatigue. It can cause sleep issues. It can cause, weight gain is what I'm getting to. So I've had experiences where I had a woman who she had a 3-year-old at the time, and I did food sensitivity testing on her, and she came back after the first month of her eating her food sensitivity diet, and she's like, oh my God. She said, I almost thought there was something wrong with me. She said, I lost 10 pounds in 2 weeks, and I've been trying to lose this weight for 3 years, and nothing would work, and it just fell off. And she said, I thought maybe I was dying or something, but then it just stopped. And that's what my natural weight was always this before. And she said, I thought it would keep going, but it just stayed where, you know, at that point. So that's just a kind of a drastic example of something. Another one, I remember I had a teenager, like probably about 10 years ago, and I didn't even see her food sensitivity test, but I knew what her symptoms were. And so I asked her between the first and second appointment to just eliminate dairy. And she lost 13 pounds in the 4 weeks between those two times. And she said, I'm like, were you hungry? She said, no, I just replaced it with other things. She probably was less hungry. But the weight just like fell off of her. And that's not the case with everybody, but a lot of people that happens, like a certain amount of weight will just fall off when you're not eating things that are causing inflammation. So a food sensitivity also, what it is, this is an antibody to a food. It's called an IgG antibody. And when you have an allergy, that's an immediate reaction, like peanut or pollen, and that's called an IgE antibody. And so I call the IgG antibody the couch potato of antibodies, because it can take up to 72 hours to have a reaction. So it's also a lot more difficult to figure out what you're reacting to, because it can take so long. Like you could say it was carrots, which is a random thing I'm choosing, but and you ate carrots 2 or 3 times a week. You would never remove them long enough to know that you're having a reaction, because the reaction can last for up to 72 hours, and it cannot happen for 72 hours. So, and most people don't just have one. Like people, we'll get a test back and they'll say, oh, this is all the stuff I eat. Well, gee, if you have holes in your gut, it's all the stuff that you eat that's going to get through. So that's one really good reason for chewing your food really well. If you did have a leaky gut, even if you don't, chewing your food breaks it down so that your enzymes don't have to do as much work, and you're more likely to get the amino acids in your bloodstream instead of the protein. So, any questions? Yes.
So when you have leaky gut, do they stay open all the time, or will they eventually close if you do some remedy?
Yeah, you can. It is something that is challenging, I will say, but you can heal a leaky gut. It takes time. It's not an overnight thing. Like, I would say 6 months to 18 months. And some people, it's so bad that it might never heal. But for most people, you know, it can take about that long. And one of the key things is to remove the offending agent that's causing the inflammation in the first place. So removing all the foods is important, which a lot of people don't do, and they don't realize that that's important. So, but yeah. Okay, the next one was hypothyroidism. I treat a lot of people for hypothyroidism, and a lot of people who thought they had hypothyroidism, they get their, and I, it's an example, this, I had a patient this afternoon, a new patient, and she had a TSH done, which is thyroid stimulating hormone, which is what standard medical doctor orders, and it was fine, and I ordered a full thyroid panel with 9 different things because I know that the TSH is a signal from your brain. It's not even indicative of what your thyroid is doing necessarily. And there are other things that can impact the TSH level rather than just the thyroid hormone, because the thyroid hormone is supposed to tell your brain, okay, I have enough, or no, I don't. And then the TSH level rises or decreases accordingly. But that doesn't always happen. And so when you order the full panel, you can see a lot of the times people's symptoms are coming from hypothyroidism or from hypothyroid-like symptoms, even though you can't technically diagnose them with hypothyroidism. And then I may treat them even though they're not technically hypothyroid, but there are 15 symptoms that they had on the checklist that we did go away pretty quickly. So... And one of the reasons why hypothyroidism is such a big thing with weight is because your metabolism just stops. And literally every single cell in your body has a thyroid receptor on it. And the reason why the symptoms are so far-reaching when you have hypothyroidism is because every cell if every cell doesn't get the hormone, then the function of the cell shuts down. So like, say you have cold hands and feet. Well, those aren't vital organs, so your body's going to shut down, you know, giving the thyroid hormone to that. Or you can, like, literally any symptom I can think of, almost, you can be caused by low thyroid hormone. And I'll just list a few of them, like hair loss, heart palpitations, fatigue, insomnia, excessive earwax, which is an interesting one, anxiety, depression, PMS, water retention, low libido, joint pain, morning stiffness, the list goes on and on and on. And the different people will have different symptoms. Like, it's kind of like, you know, one person gets sick, they always get a cough. Another person gets sick, they always get a throat infection. Why? I don't know, but we all have a propensity for certain things in our bodies to go awry. Weight loss is a huge thing. And when your thyroid, like say someone's thyroid medication isn't at the right level, they could gain 10 pounds in a day, literally, and it would take them a month to lose that weight. So it's really important to have that be in check if you're having difficulty losing weight. So candida. Candida is related to food sensitivities. So food sensitivities can be caused by chronic candida, which is yeast, an overgrowth of yeast in your body. A lot of people think that a yeast infection is only women get it, and it's only in your vagina, but that's not true. They can be systemic, and that doesn't, you know, medical doctors often think that's just the AIDS patient who's dying who gets a yeast infection. But I do stool tests for yeast all the time, and we treat it, and people get better. But it's a big reason why people gain weight or have difficulty losing weight, and if you treat the infection. I had a patient one time who, this was before she came to see me. She said, I think I must have an infection again because I've gained all this weight and you need to help me. She'd been somewhere in Europe and they had treated her for a yeast infection. She lost like 20 pounds in a month. And she said, it was a miracle. I think I must have this again because she'd gained all the weight back. But it is very common to lose a lot more weight than you would expect to lose just by treating the yeast infection. And then there are other bacterial infections that I find in people too. And so when you have toxins being produced by these things that are living in your body, it's like if we filled this room with garbage, it's hard to function in here. It's hard, it might be hard for you to see me or hear me. And so the signaling can't happen as well in the cells. And so metabolism gets slowed down and we have difficulty losing weight. So symptoms that are common, if you have candida, like gas, bloating, abdominal pain, fatigue, brain fog, which is a big one, and weight gain. And something actually I've noticed a lot in people more recently, I'm not sure why, is nausea. So people who have chronic nausea or have intermittent nausea, I have found that a lot of them have an infection. We treat the infection and the nausea goes away. So sex hormones. Why sex hormones? Different hormones can cause different things, and usually the interplay of the hormones is what's, I mean, it always affects us in some way or another. So progesterone, when we have, if you've ever heard of PCOS, PCOS is polycystic ovarian syndrome, which a lot of girls and women have, they tend to have difficulty losing weight, and it actually comes from insulin resistance. And I will explain, did I explain insulin resistance? No, I didn't, not yet. Insulin resistance causes, can increase testosterone levels in women, can cause increase in DHEA, which is another hormone that I haven't mentioned here, but one of the things that it does is it prevents people from ovulating. And if you don't ovulate, your progesterone levels go down. And so the 2 weeks before your period, that's when all the PMS symptoms usually happen. So like breast tenderness, moodiness, even cramps, headaches, all those kinds of things can be caused by low progesterone. And another thing that low progesterone does is help, makes you hold on to water weight more. So when people, if someone were to take progesterone for the first time, if they're really conscious of their body, they'll notice that they're peeing a lot. And it's because their body's letting go of all the water once their progesterone level goes up. So progesterone can make you feel heavier and actually weigh more. It's not necessarily fat, but testosterone. Oh, that's another thing. Progesterone, there is a progesterone receptor on all of our cells too. And it allows the cell to let the thyroid hormone into the nucleus of the cell to make it function. And so when we have low progesterone, it can mimic hypothyroidism. So sometimes if your thyroid hormones are normal, it might be that you just have low progesterone. It's pretty simple. There's so many different things going on, but it's one thing that can happen. So testosterone, you know, the typical beer belly that a man gets, as testosterone goes down as they get older, their insulin resistance increases in their belly, and so they start getting fat in their belly. And women, when they go through menopause, when the estrogen goes down, their fat deposits shift from the hips and thighs to the abdomen, and that's because of how estrogen impacts insulin and another hormone that I'm not going to talk about right now. So it makes people have difficulty losing weight, so even more difficulty losing weight as you get older and your hormones change. Insulin resistance. So I've mentioned this a bunch of times, and now I'm going to explain it. So if we have insulin, insulin is a hormone that you think of as, what's insulin? Does anyone know what insulin does?
Regulates your body's management of sugar.
Regulates your body's management of sugar. So, yes, but you know what its biggest job is? It's a fat storage hormone. So the more insulin we have, the more fat we're going to store. So the reason why insulin resistance is so not good for us is because when you have insulin resistance, your body keeps pumping out more and more and more to try and get your cells to open up and take the sugar in. So basically, insulin is a key to a cell to open the door and let the sugar in. And when it doesn't work, it's called insulin resistance. So you have these little things that float around in the cells. It's like a little, Doctor Who just popped into my head. You know how he goes into the box and he walks out on the other side in another time. So that little box is the glucose transporter. It's called the GLUT4 something. I haven't looked at that in a long time. But basically different things which increase the body's ability to use insulin properly, help move those little boxes to the edge of the cell so they can open up and take the sugar in and then make energy with them. So when we have insulin resistance, that does not happen very well. And what ends up happening is because all this sugar that's floating around that's supposed to be going into your cells to make energy, your body has to maintain homeostasis. So it packages it up in a triglyceride and sends it off to your fat cell and stores it away for a time when you might be in a famine, which I don't think is going to happen anytime soon around here. Reasons why insulin resistance can be caused by lack of sleep. I found a study that showed after two consecutive nights of sleep of less than 4 hours, insulin resistance increased by 12 to 21% in all of the participants. That's a lot. So what if you're chronically sleep deprived like I am with a 6-8-month-old baby? You've probably also heard that the more you sleep, the less you weigh. People who sleep in excess of, it's 7 or more hours a night, will weigh 5 to 15 pounds lighter than people who sleep less than that. We don't know everything about the body. There are probably many things at play, but that's one of the reasons is this insulin resistance. So low magnesium levels can increase insulin resistance. High sugar intake, high fructose corn syrup especially, lack of exercise, and the standard American diet. And one of the reasons the standard American diet can cause insulin resistance is because of nutrient deficiency. Like, there is some huge percentage of the population who, if their vegetable was not ketchup, they don't eat any vegetables, which is sad, but true. When I could just give a simple example, there's a product that I use for blood sugar balancing, and it has a whole bunch of different minerals in it. And so if you think about modern farming, we don't rotate our crops the way we're supposed to. We don't replenish the soils. And we don't fertilize it with a natural fertilizer. We fertilize it with some concocted thing. And I compare it to breast milk. Like, formula is not the perfect food for a baby. Breast milk is. And composted fertilizer is the perfect, soil for something. For corn or for soy or for, those are horrible examples, but for vegetables and whatever else is growing. Carrots. But so we can't get the nutrients into a vegetable if the nutrients aren't in the soil. That's where they come from. So it's not like rocket science to realize that if we don't feed our soil, our food's not going to feed us the same way it should if the soil had a, the nutrients in it that it was supposed to. Cortisol levels. So cortisol comes from your adrenal glands. Your adrenal glands are two little fatty glands that sit on top of your kidneys. And when I was in gross lab in school, I can tell you they actually look like little, they look a little bit like fatty lumps of butter. They're yellow and and they're not very big. So our adrenal glands release different hormones, one of which is cortisol, another one is epinephrine, and epinephrine is actually adrenaline. It's the adrenaline is the old name for epinephrine. So when we are stressed, we increase, our body releases more cortisol, and more cortisol causes our body to release more insulin. If we have more insulin, what are we going to do? Store more fat. We're going to store more fat. So that's how being stressed leads to weight gain. Here's another thing. I'll explain this. So I have an example. I had a patient probably about, 7 years ago. She came in after she had come in for insomnia. And one time when I was seeing her, I said, how have you been sleeping? She goes, oh, I've been sleeping pretty well, but last night was bad. And I said, oh, you probably had a glass of wine. She said, how did you know? And I told her that when your body gets, like, so this is, you know, if you have dessert or something extra sweet, or if you eat a dessert and you don't have dinner or whatever, your body will anticipate that you're going to eat something sweet again, however many hours later. And so it's to stop your body from having a rise in blood sugar. But the problem is, if you have a glass of wine at night, you're not going to have another one in the middle of the night. So what happens is your insulin goes up, and it allows some of the, depending on how insulin resistant you are, the sugar to go into your cells to make energy. So as your sugar drops, your body alarm bells go off. So it spits out adrenaline or epinephrine and says, hey, lady, you need to go find some food. And so people wake up, they're wide awake. It takes them hours to fall back to sleep. And the solution for that, besides not drinking a glass of wine in the moment, is to have a little snack. And usually, like within 5 minutes or 10 minutes, you'll fall right back to sleep. So that's another way stress hormones can affect you. But if your blood sugar is that, you know, up and down and up and down, you've got to pump out more insulin to try and remedy it all the time. If it stays more stable, you have a much lower level of insulin. And the more insulin resistant you are, depending on all those other factors we just talked about, I just lost my train of thought. Basically, you end up gaining more weight. So, too many carbohydrates. So this kind of leads me into what I'm going to be talking about next time. For the longest time, people have been trying to avoid fat. And if you think back to, like, probably before the 50s, different cultures think different things depending on what they know about nutrition. But I will confess to, I'm a big lover of butter, and I joke sometimes that my children are made out of butter. That's how much butter I eat. But if I have meat, I will cut the gristle off the meat. I won't eat it. And I used to live in Abu Dhabi before I went to naturopathic school, and my roommate was British. And every time we would eat together, I would kind of like, my eyes would pop out of my head at the things she would eat from, you know, the meat, every little itty bitty morsel of fat she would eat, and she didn't think anything of it. But even though in my mind, I have thought fat was fine, I, I, I realize subconsciously it has been kind of drilled into me. And maybe I just don't like the fat, the taste of that. I don't know. But if fat is melted into something, I certainly do like it.
Especially butter.
So carbohydrates regulate insulin levels. So insulin, this is the big thing to know. The more insulin you have in your blood, the more insulin your pancreas pumps out, the more you're going to store fat. So the key is, if a carbohydrate stimulates insulin release, what's probably what you should do is not eat so many carbohydrates. And your body has two energy sources that it can burn. One is fat and one is sugar. And it's always going to burn sugar first. So if you never give it a chance to burn all the sugar up, and your body has between 2 and 3, I'm just talking about a typical person, 2 and 3,000 calories worth of sugar. If you don't ever let that get burned, you don't get into fat burning. So for people who think it's impossible to lose weight, there's a reason. They're not turning on the fat burning switch. So if you don't ever reduce carbs enough or sugar enough for that to happen, you just won't lose weight. And I, the last few years, I've been a big proponent of the paleo diet. Whether I entirely follow it or not is another question. But in theory, I really like the idea. I like the idea of people eating what we think people used to eat for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years. But I would have a few patients who would say, I've been eating paleo for 2 years and I cannot lose this weight. And no matter how good they think they're being, it just, nothing happens. And so when you switch to being able to burn fat, then you can start losing weight again. And the one thing that the paleo thing is missing is the fat, is the importance of fat. And so another thing to know is, like, protein can also be burned as sugar. So if you eat too much protein, you also have a hard time getting into the fat burning mode and can have a hard time losing weight. And I know, like, the Atkins diet was really popular for a while and then got poo-pooed because people thought it was unhealthy. But the real Atkins diet, I think people thought they were doing the Atkins diet but weren't really fully doing it. But everyone thought it was, like, low carb, high protein, and eat whatever kind of fat, could be trans fat, could be whatever, and then we learned more about fat. But the real Atkins diet, the way it is now, is actually pretty effective at helping people lose weight. Another thing to know is that if insulin is a fat storage hormone and we want to lose weight, the only thing that does not stimulate insulin is fat. So the one last thing I will leave you with is that the thing that I started consuming in March was MCT oil. And MCT oil comes from coconut oil. And coconut oil has, so MCT stands for medium chain triglycerides. And it has ketones in it. And your body burns, that oil as fat. It doesn't have to convert it to anything. It just can burn it directly as fat. And so it helps sustain your energy longer. You don't have to worry about insulin spikes as much if you add it to something, because it won't stimulate the insulin as much. And one reason why it is a little bit better than coconut oil is because it's just a higher percentage of medium chain triglycerides. So coconut oil will do the same thing, just not at the same rate that the MCT oil would do. So I'm going to open it up for questions. If you have any questions, or you want to try the Beamer, you're welcome to. And thank you for coming. And if you can join us on September 7th, I'd be happy to have you. Mm-hmm.